Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit from Louisville Public Media.
Welcome back, dear listeners. So, Doc, of course, you're a college professor. And yes. Something we talk about frequently, you know, when you and I are chilling, and then, you know, of course, I've been a perpetual college student on and off for the last 20 years, basically, is that just how interesting the college campus is, and it's like a bubble.
Yeah, it is
that,
a bubble.
And you often talk about how students feel insulated, and sometimes that can translate to entitlement or any number of different emotions because the college campus is a very unique space.
Mm-hmm.
But I think on the plus side, what it allows is student activism to develop, that a lot of times students, if you will, sharpen their claws, whether it comes to protesting administration or protesting racist policies or transphobic, like that we don't have trans inclusive bathrooms or any number of other kind of social or political policies. A lot of your students over the years, a lot of our peers over the various two decades have gotten into activism on a college campus.
Yeah, they inadvertently become woke in some senses.
Yeah. But on the bad part, Doc, is of course that they also then don't know how to operate in the real world, so to speak.
Very much so. Yeah. And interpret the real world as it's going to be basically the same as a college campus, and it's not. And so it is a rude awakening in a lot of senses for young, up-and-coming, inspired activists to get into the real world and find out it's nothing like a college campus.
Yeah, and you wonder how much of those life skills you learn on the college campus would translate into the real world, right? And so what am I getting at, listeners? What I'm getting at is our guest today is Zane Singh. Zane wrote a piece for Medium.com that really struck my fancy. It was called Beyond the Bubble, How Transphobia Permeates the Wokest of Them All. And so, listeners, please welcome to the show Zane Singh. Zane, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. I'm well. Thank you. So I kind of set that story up, but I love your piece because it reminds us that even those of us who are on college campus, or even those of us who aren't necessarily in college, who consider ourselves to be woke and consider ourselves to be activists or allies or advocates for other groups of people, that sometimes we fall short. And so talk to our listeners about what happened to you that led you, the situation that happened to you, hanging out with some friends, going to get some food or some drink, that led you kind of to write this larger piece.
Yeah, for sure. So it was at the end of kind of last semester of my sophomore year. And I basically had just gone out with some friends to grab some boba, Southern California. It's, you know, boba is like the thing. So we had just gone out, you know, maybe like across the street from where campus is into what's known as like our college town and village. And just within like our crossing the street off of the edge of campus and into this boba place, you know, we go in, we get our boba, we come out, we're about to go into the car, and another car kind of just drives past and stops really slowly, rolls down their window, and inside are two white boys, and they open up and they go, "Hey, are you a girl or are you a boy? We need to know so we can decide whether or not we're going to f*** you." And then they just kind of laugh and then drive right past. And the interesting thing about that, besides the fact that I was being attacked for being trans, getting boba, was the fact that my two friends who were with me, who are often seen as the biggest leaders of student activism on this campus, didn't say anything. They didn't know what to say. Either it was they didn't know what to say. They didn't know how to say anything. And it was almost as if like they just let this transphobic action and this event take place, even though on a college campus, they probably would have said something because they're defending their own ego and their own sense of wokeness, if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense.
That's kind of the situation, yeah.
In that moment when they didn't respond, were you surprised? Did it reinforce some feelings you already felt? Like, yeah, y'all gonna get off this college campus and not be speaking truth to power the way you do on the yard, right? I mean, just how did you feel in that moment from their lack of response?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think it was a mixture. I think for me at first it was like, okay, am I physically safe to say anything back to the people who just drove past us, right? Because I was angry. You know, I wanted to say something. I wanted to be like, y'all don't know what you're talking about. You need to get a grip and stop being transphobic, right? But for me, I didn't feel safe enough to do that. So then, you know, I kind of turned to these two friends who I had, you know, assumed were allies, and they had gone through allyship training and they knew how to be allies, not saying anything. And I think that's when I got kind of angry. I was like, y'all claim to be allies. You run around and have this label of I am a queer ally. I support anybody who identifies as LGBTQ+, but then you don't actually take the steps to show your allyship when it's needed most. And I think that was what bothered me about that whole situation. So I think it was kind of a mixture. Like, I was surprised, but I also was like kind of angry and And like, I'm not really surprised that you didn't do it. But then again, you know, if you're going to go through the hassle of being an ally and going through allyship training and working with students and other people who are identifying as LGBTQ and plus, like, why would you not then practice those skills in a real life situation?
Yeah, absolutely. So. You talk in your piece about, and I close my eyes, Zane, and envision myself kind of being there with you. And for me, it was whether because of my queerness, but mostly because of my blackness. And I think about like those times when if I had been in that situation as a black dude and been with some white friends, for example. And so the people yell, what they yell to you out of the car. And then you get back into the car, your friends kind of say like, you know, they kind of pretend or they say that they don't really know what the person said. And so they say to you like, did you hear what they said or whatever? And you repeat what they said. And so their reactions were, you know, oh, that sucks. Are you okay? Kind of appeasing, but first of all, you're like, first of all, it isn't whatever. It's not what they said or whatever. And so for me, I wondered, like, even the notion of if your friends did not even hear exactly what the harasser had said, then there's almost even a luxury in that. Like for me, if I'm walking down the street, you know, in Valley Station, back where my mom lives, which is a predominantly white neighborhood, mm-hmm. every time a car drives past me, if I'm going to get to the mailbox, if I'm going to get the newspaper, every time a car goes past me with a white person driving, I'm prepared. My ears are perked up, right? Mm. You know, like my I'm paying attention that something's going to be yelled to me from that car. So I'm almost hyper vigilant. And so I wonder for you, Zane, as a person who's trans identified, if you know that maybe the cis people take as a luxury that you always have to be hyper vigilant as to what someone may say to you, what someone may do to you, that there might be imposing physical or emotional threats. Do you find yourself having to be perhaps vigilant in a way that people who are not trans take for granted?
Yeah, always. I think part of it is, you know, I attend a women's college, right? So the colleges that I go to are a consortium. We consist of 5 schools, but the specific school that I am attending and will graduate from is an all-women's college. So for me to be coming out as a trans man in a space where it's all women, it's like the most, like, it's just the craziest feeling because I don't know when I might be attacked or when I might be, like, my physical safety or my, like, emotional stability or my mental health would just go out the window because it feels as though at any point in time, some student can say something to me about the fact that I'm a man at a women's college. And that there can be all sorts of conversations that can go left and right and out in all sorts of crazy places that I don't know if I can handle, right? I can't be the only person that's educating people at a women's college that men can exist on these campuses and even at a women's college because gender is a spectrum, right? I can't be that only person. And so I think I do walk around with my ears kind of perked up because, you know, as soon as I walk into my dorm, if I see another woman, especially if they're a white woman passing me and they kind of give me like the up and down stare, like I don't want to have to deal with, you know, some kind of like side comment or whatever, because then I'm going to have to explain to myself and explain to them why I'm existing here. Why do I live at this campus? Why do I go to this school if I'm a man? Right. I think that's kind of one of the things that I would say I always am aware of all the time. And then it just becomes like, if I'm walking around one of the other campuses, just in general, if I see like a cis man walking around, or if I see another cis woman, or if I'm with my partner, my partner is explaining to someone that, you know, their boyfriend goes to this college that's a women's college, and they get all confused and they're like, what? That doesn't make any sense. Like, he's a man. That doesn't make sense. He shouldn't be at this women's college. And I'm like, well, we exist in all areas and all sectors of universities and learning and spheres of living. Like, you know, you can't just expect us to live in one specific tiny little place in your mind that like just doesn't exist, if that makes sense. Yeah.
No, it makes total sense to both of us. And so in that piece, like, well, I wanted to ask, are the curriculum or is the curriculum at your college and at your school when you were there and when you attended, did it reinforce this kind of faux wokeness or the fake wokeness? Did you have any kind of LGBT courses or anything that taught students how to be an ally? Like, where did these college leaders that basically didn't show up when they needed to show up. Where did they get this feigned sense of wokeness? Like, was it embedded in the institution in and of itself? You know, just speak a little bit about how the college in and of itself, that environment probably facilitated this kind of fake wokeness.
Yeah, for sure. I think it comes from a couple different places. I think it starts definitely in high school. There are a lot of students who come with a really, really great high school education into these really elite institutions, and it sort of starts and stems from there. And then I would say that the institutions of higher education, especially in undergrad, and then further on into graduate school, it becomes this pearl of everything that the institution stands for, that our students are activists, that we are really, really well aware and really, really well learned and well read, and that we know everything that's happening at every point in time about every single political situation that can ever exist. And I think that then just kind of grows and it permeates into every class, even if it's like a technical course on, you know, programming languages. Like it stems into everything. It's not just humanity classes. It becomes this like culture of we are the elite institution, so therefore our students are woke, are activists, are always on top of everything, and they know how to respond to every single situation, even if they don't even identify as LGBTQ+. They are definitely allies. They're never going to be transphobic. They're never going to be homophobic. This is what our institution basically prides itself on. And I think within the classes, then the professors just kind of have this assumption that everybody is super well read. And, you know, for me, I didn't really go to that great of a high school. I went to school on the south side of Chicago, where it was me just trying to graduate on time. And I think it was so different for me to come to this institution where everybody is so well read on everything, or believes that they're so well read. And then in class, they feel like they have this like, I don't know, kind of like almost power or authority to be able to say certain things that they don't actually have true experiences to. And it becomes this kind of fake wokeness of like, hey, like this professor is talking about the gender spectrum. And then these students who are very much cisgender will totally say, yeah, I can totally relate to that. And that makes no sense in my head. Like, how can you, as a cisgender person who's never experienced anything of questioning your gender, of being anywhere on the gender spectrum, say that you can relate to being trans? Like, to me, that doesn't make any sense in my head. So I think it kind of comes from like this culture of high school to then the institutions and what they want to stand for, and then to all of our kind of social student groups.
Well, I'll tell you what, Zane, the part that is most poetic perhaps to me in your piece is at the end, when you talk about wokeness not being an aesthetic. And I'm going to read a direct quote for our listeners. It says, being woke is not an aesthetic. It is not something to wear on a T-shirt or to proclaim to every person in the room. It's not meant to be your shield or your mask to paint you as, quote, not that ignorant guy. It's meant to be your tool, your sword, your weapon of choice to use when the dragons come out beyond the bubble. To be woke is to defend and fight for the voices of those who can't speak because they're muffled by the towel that is hate, anger, oppression, and ignorance. To be woke is to know your facts and to use them when someone is spreading fake news about gender dysphoria being a disease or genetic mutation. To be woke is to realize other people's oppression is not a hammer to nail your reputation together. To be woke is to not back down, even when you are fighting for someone other than yourself. So before we let you go, you say to be woke is to be powerful, and only some people have the right to that title. Let us know, Zane, for those of us who really feel like we want to earn the right to that title, to be woke, to be powerful, to be the best ally and accomplice and best friend that we can be to others, what advice do you have when those moments come down? When I'm with my homie, we're going to get boba, which, by the way, what is boba? For those of us here in the South and the Midwest, tell us quickly. I Googled it, and it says bubble tea. Tell us what it is, please.
I didn't know what boba was until I came out here. So I'm from the Midwest, too. I grew up in Chicago, so I didn't know what it was. It's basically like a Thai tea, and at the bottom they have these, like, tapioca pearl things that, like, when you drink the tea, it's like you chew on this tapioca with this super sweet Thai tea. I don't know. It's like very, yeah, I have no idea.
Wow. I love it. Okay, so we're going to get boba with our homie and someone yells something completely crazy, something racist, something sexist, transphobic from the window of their car. What do we need to do to really embody our wokeness and our powerfulness? What advice do you have for folk?
I think that is when you take all of the knowledge and the skills and everything that you have learned from, and I'm speaking for college students in particular, of like, from your institution and from your classes, and you take all of that and you apply it to this real life situation. Show me that you are an ally when it comes and it matters most. So basically, give me everything that you've learned and put it into what's happening right now. If you are able to take that and you're able to make it something concrete, and it's no longer just this idea, this concept that we're talking about in class and analyzing from every perspective, and you can make it something that actually means helping and being there for somebody who cannot actually speak or say something or do something, that is true allyship. That is true wokeness. I don't want to see anybody doing fake woke stuff outside of their, you know, college institution. Fine, you can talk about it in the classroom, but when it matters most is when you can earn that title to be the wokest person I know.
I love it. Listeners, love it. Zane Singh describes himself as a friendly neighborhood soft boy. I tell you what, Zane has plenty of writings on Medium.com. Zane's name is spelled Zaynsingh. Go to Medium.com, type in his name, and read some of his really, really powerful pieces. Zane, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. We wish you the best.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yes, take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Zane. Right, bye.
Bye.
All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. Let the people know who we are.
You're listening to Strange Fruit from Louisville Public Media.
On the newest episode of Five Things, it's civil rights attorney Dan Cannon telling the truth about what it's really like to run for Congress.
You have to know a little bit of something about everything, enough to talk confidently about a bajillion different subjects. I can't think of any other way that I would have been able to meaningfully learn that stuff at the age that I am without having done that. So yeah, tremendously rewarding all the way around. Still, you know, awful.
Five Things, available now.
Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit from Louisville Public Media.
Doc, so there's been a number of things we talked about over the last 6 years of doing this show. We've covered pretty much everything under the umbrella of LGBTQ+, right? We've covered a whole lot of stuff.
Yes.
But there's one area I don't think that we've really covered, which is why when I saw this article on ArcherMagazine.com, I was like, dang, like, this is the area about which I don't know a lot of stuff. I'm sure that probably you can learn something. I'm sure that our listeners can learn something. Mm-hmm. And so this particular article is called Ace Up My Sleeve, Coming Out as Asexual. And I was like, dang, like, you know, like I have kind of in my mind a notion of what asexuality is. And we've heard the term certainly, but I don't know much about it. And so we're very lucky to have on the show today, Gabby Ryan. Please welcome to the show, Gabby Ryan. Gabby, how are you?
Thank you.
You're joining us all the way from Australia, yes?
Yes, that's right.
Good. And with let our listeners know, by the way, it's a technicality brought to us by the beauty of Skype. And so Skype is helping us make this connection. So to mention, Gabby, you wrote this article in November, and it talks about coming out as asexual. So let's just start from the very beginning. What does it mean to identify as something, as you pose it, that is essentially an absence? What does asexual mean?
It's a fairly new thing for me as well, thinking about this. I've sort of tried lots of different labels and played with them over the time, and I've sort of, none of them are really quite fit. And so I kind of recently been thinking about the fact that, I mean, sex doesn't play a big part in my life. I'm in a long-term relationship with a cishet man, so it's sort of straight passing, I suppose, but the label straight's never really fit. But then I sort of started thinking about the asexuality label and then kind of playing with that, and it sort of seemed to feel comfortable. And it seems to be an absence, because asexuality sort of means, it doesn't mean no sexuality, but it means no sex, I suppose. I guess that's what the concept of it, the simple concept of it in most people's minds. So it seems like living without sex, but actually for me, it's a whole identity in itself.
That's amazing. Tell us a little bit about your journey to asexuality, for you to identify yourself. Like in the article, you talk about having school age crushes and kind of intentionally choosing people to crush on, to fit in with folks and stuff like that. But just share with our listeners a little bit about the journey where you said, you know what, I'm asexual. I'm not bisexual. I'm not lesbian. I'm asexual.
Yep. Well, I suppose I haven't had all that many relationships. I have sort of, as you say, when I was younger, I sort of I had crushes on people, but I felt like it was because I was supposed to do that, I suppose. And I kind of, I really remember when I was 12 years old sort of thinking, oh, I better have a boyfriend before I'm 13 because otherwise I'm sort of being left behind. And I kind of always felt like that. And it was always at that stage, it was always very straight assumptions. And then through high school, I had crushes on boys, and a lot of them, and as I got older, a lot of them tended to be friends. So it was more, I actually had a relationship with the person as a friend, but there was, and I always wanted that to be something more. And I'm looking back now thinking maybe in wanting that to be something more, it stopped me from appreciating what it actually was at the time. Then as I got older and sort of got to the age where I was going out and starting to drink alcohol and things like that, I had sort of one night stands and things like that, mostly with blokes, mostly with men, but occasionally sort of dallied with women. And interestingly, when I sort of hooked up with women, I suppose, it was a bit more interesting to me. It was a bit more scary because it sort of felt like a bit more real. And that's what kind of made me sort of think maybe I'm a lesbian, but I never really explored it, maybe because I was a bit too scared of it. And I'm not sure. I still haven't really unpacked all of that. But then when I got into this, my current relationship with a man, I started thinking about that, you know, in the early days we sort of had sex like most people do, I suppose, but that sort of petered off reasonably quickly, and for the last couple of years it hasn't been a big part of our life at all. And that sort of made me start thinking about whether that was something we should have been doing more of, or whether that was, and it's never really sat well with me that people sort of automatically assume that that means the relationship's not working if we're not having a lot of sex, because we are very affectionate, we have got pet names, we do lots of cuddles and kisses, and that's really important to us. So this, the physical affection is there. I'm not aromantic, and we have a strong romantic attachment. So it never sat right when people sort of, you know, assumed that because we didn't have a lot of sexual contact that that meant the relationship wasn't working. So yeah. I guess that's what kind of started me thinking about it from a fairly safe space of already being in this relationship in which I could kind of analyze it, I suppose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I like that you point out that asexual does not necessarily mean aromantic. And so, yeah. So, and I'm sorry if I'm being elementary here, but I'm just curious. So if I see someone, so in other words, are people still attractive to you? Like, do you still look at people and say, oh, he's cute, or, oh, he has a nice body, or any of those? So do those things still exist, and it's just that there's no desire to, if you will, go all the way? Because you mentioned you still have cuddles, you still have kisses. So there are still, yep, things that might be considered, you know, petty, if you will. But so you're, yep, still a person who finds people attractive, who still wants romance, who still wants to perhaps, you know, Netflix and chill or go to dinner. So those things still exist. Yes, the romance part.
The romance part's definitely there. In terms of, you know, seeing sort of someone and thinking, oh, they're cute or whatever, for me it's never the case that I look at someone and my first thought is that they're attractive, that I'd like to, you know, kiss them or cuddle them or whatever. I do understand what conventional attraction looks like, conventional good looks or whatever. I can appreciate that, and in all genders, I suppose. But it's never my first thought if I was to see someone on the street or on a train, I'd really like to, you know, hook up with that person. If I see someone that I'm sort of interested in that I look at twice, it's usually because, you know, they've got some interesting jewelry on or interesting tattoos or, yeah, you know, they're reading an interesting book or something. So it's something that kind of gives me an into a conversation, or it might be something that's an interesting smile or interesting kind of striking eyes or something that is a physical feature, but it's a physical feature that leads me to wonder about their story and their personality, yeah, rather than just sort of a physical feature. And I'd really love to run my hands over those shoulders or something like that.
Yes. Yes. I love it.
No, yeah, I love it too. So, you know, your kind of attraction, if there is one, has to do more with the person in total, something about their personality, something about their energy, their voice, so on and so forth. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, exactly. That's true. And it's always something that I wonder about their story more. And I guess that's one of the things that I've been thinking about lately, because I never really thought that wasn't what attraction was, I suppose. I've never really thought about it. I've kind of played the game of saying, oh, you know, he's cute, or, you know, she's beautiful or whatever. And I can believe that. But it's often when someone describes someone as physically attractive, I go, oh, yeah, I guess they are.
Like an afterthought, like, oh, yeah, they are. Kind of cute. Yeah,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, exactly. And I can see it. But usually someone, so if someone who is physically attractive, if they're not a nice person or if I don't, you know, connect with them, then I won't see that physical attraction anymore. It won't mean anything to me. And if someone who wasn't originally considered to be physically attractive and then they, you know, I get to know them. And I know that's true for everybody. Once they have a connection with someone, then someone can become more or less attractive based on a connection or the personality that sort of comes through eventually. But for me, I think that that's kind of more immediate, or it happens sooner perhaps in the relationship than having to develop a deep relationship either negatively or positively.
Yeah, no. So now that you kind of had this long journey at coming into your asexuality, you're in this really happy, loving, romantic relationship with your current partner. So do you find yourself performing other sexualities like you did in adolescence, or are you pretty much like, I'm asexual, if, you know, I guess I'm asking, like, is there a kind of formal outing of yourself in any kind of realm, whether that's workspaces or do you kind of just feel like it's our business?
Yeah, because
and nobody's
you mentioned
business
in the article that you don't like being read as straight, right? That mm-hmm. part of you was like, well, what I do is my own personal business, but then you also don't quite feel cool when people see your cishet partner and read you as straight. That doesn't feel right to you. So, yeah, what is that like? Do you find yourself, like, I might be at my job, like, constantly reiterating my queerness, or Doc does. How does that work for you in those same spaces?
Yeah, I guess I've sort of not really thought of myself as straight. I've got a lot of queer friends, and in conversations with them, I'm sort of talking about myself almost as one of them, even though I haven't sort of had the same experience of discrimination that they may have had, because I've been straight passing and continue to be. So I haven't had that same sort of experience that they might talk about, but when they sort of talk about, you know, queer culture or whatever, I relate to that much more. I read a lot of novels and books by queer authors and with queer themes, and I prefer them to novels that don't sort of have that, or that have that if reasonably kind of straightforward, boring, heteronormative kind of enforcement. So I guess that I have not really, especially for the last couple of years, thought of myself as straight, but I kind of haven't known what that's meant in terms. And I sort of then thought maybe I'm bisexual for a while, but then I hadn't explored that physically because I'm in a exclusive relationship. So yeah. I sort of thought, oh, if that relationship wasn't there, then I probably would make an effort probably to hook up with women more than men, just to kind of explore that side of things a bit more. And maybe that's still true, but I don't know what that would look like, and it's kind of a moot point at the moment, of course. Yeah. But in terms of coming out, that's kind of an interesting question. I haven't come out sort of too broadly. I haven't made a big statement. I guess the article was kind of what that was in a way. Archer magazine did a call out on Twitter to ask for stories about asexuality, and particularly intimacy in asexual relationships was what they were interested in. So I pitched my story to them and they were interested in it. So I sort of wrote that, and I did pitch it, and that obviously the headline of the article sort of says that's a coming out story, and I guess that's kind of what that was. And I've sort of, beyond that, I've sort of gone to changing my Twitter bio to say that I'm a pan-romantic asexual kind of thing. But that's kind of as far as it's got. Yeah. And I don't know that it needs to be beyond that, but I guess if someone was to ask how I identified, then I would quite clearly say that.
Yeah. Perhaps your favorite part of your piece to me, Gabby, was, and it's something I can relate to, you say that perhaps for me, romance and friendship are somewhere on the same spectrum, and the step from one to the other is something other than sex. And so for me, as someone who, you know, I'm a consummate heartbreaker, you know, I love the men and leave the men. But for someone like me, I really value, and Doc, you know this, you know, I really value friendships so much more than relationships. I mean, yeah. You know, I can take a boy or leave a boy, right? But I'm much more invested in maintaining friendships. Like, to me, you know, I've dated boys who I've been in love with and the sex life wasn't there. I've had sex with men and there was no kind of like romantic love. So to me, those things have always, at least in my own mind, which I haven't talked about a lot on the show, but you and I have talked about, Doc, like sex and love to me are vastly, vastly different. And so I do appreciate, Gabby, that you say, like, for you, like, romance and friendship, like, I can be romantically, when I was I could be in love with my friends, right? Or not, or love my friends and romance. And
without that having to be eroticism.
Yeah, and romance doesn't have to be erotic. Romance can be like, yo, I have love going to movies with my friends. We have a good time. I love my friends. And so I appreciate you pointing out, you know, and that kind of blurs the area between sexual, you know, I guess between the sexuality and the asexuality. Does that make sense what I'm saying, Doc, in terms of I appreciate the pointing out of that romance and friendship are somewhere on the same spectrum, but don't have to involve sex.
Well, I also think that it's something where there are much more nuances to all sexual identities.
Yeah.
You know, now that we, you know, identities are great because they allow us to figure our own selves out, figure out the things we like that we don't like, right? But they can be boxing and confining. And so I think that, you know, I think it's great to kind of try to figure out where those fissures lie when it comes to our own sexual desires. And I think that, you know, you can be and have romantic love and that be with a friendship and with a person that is your friend. You can also be in a full-pledged relationship that's romantic and cuddly and not be having sex either, right? I mean, I love it. I love it.
Well, Gabby, I'll tell you what, it's been a delight to have you with us. All the way from Australia, you joined us. So, listeners, this has been Gabby Ryan, who is a white writer and events manager from Melbourne, Australia. She had a PhD in creative writing. Dr. Ryan, thank you so much for being with us. We wish you the best of luck.
Thanks, Gabby.
Please take care, my friend. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Yes, bye-bye. All right, what a wonderful, wonderful conversation.
I know, I loved it.
Yeah, I mean... That was a lot to... We have just so much we had never really talked about on the show. And then that was just... It's just... I'm not gonna say mind-boggling, but it's interesting, you know. And it, like you said, there's a whole lot that we don't even know about sexuality and all that, you know.
But that's why storytelling is so important. I think that what it does is it gets to the heart of the human being themselves. And so we can have these definitions, we can learn the definitions like the back of our hand, and be able to pull them out and say, "Oh, you're asexual," or "Oh, you're a lesbian," right? But it's only when we get into the human being and their personal story and journey can we really get to the point of knowing the fissures and the nuances of our sexuality, of what we find erotic, romantic, so on and so forth, you know? So our emotional well-being, those nuances that are a part of our sexualities, I think we don't get to talk about those as much. It's
absolutely.
Just, you know?
Yeah.
So absolutely. I was excited.
Well, thanks so much to both of our guests today, to Zane and also to Gabby. A really wonderful show. Zane, of course, talking about transphobia permeating even the wokest of us. And then Gabby talking about asexuality. And so I've learned a lot today from both of our guests. Have you learned a lot?
Yes,
yeah,
so
really,
much.
Really, really
so
cool.
Much.
So anyway, we hope you all enjoy your Christmas season. Hey, y'all, we're going to take off. We're going to take Christmas break the last week of the month. So there won't be a new show the last week of December, because we're going to be chilling with our families. You're going to be probably drinking some eggnog. You've been hitting that bottle hard lately.
I actually killed 2 bottles of eggnog in the last 2 weeks, so I just can't
you
have any until Christmas.
And you don't.
And it was the strongest eggnog, mind you. It was, oh my God, what
was
it? Evan Williams?
Yeah,
I was going to
point out that
eggnog.
You don't drink, because they have eggnog that is alcohol-free. But you was hitting the hard stuff.
It was Evan Williams.
Yeah, you was.
It wasn't hard. I wouldn't say it was hardcore.
Yes.
But it was Evan Williams, and it had bourbon and different kinds of whiskeys.
Yes.
As well as
some
brandy.
How much were you drinking, like a whole jug?
I just would have a glass. I would have a glass a night, but then I would be like, I would be so like buzzed, because I'm like, I don't drink normally like that, so I just was like, oh my God, I was.
What about the flavor of eggnog do you enjoy? Because for me, I don't know if it's the.
I like the cinnamon and nutmeg.
Okay.
I put cinnamon and nutmeg in my coffee sometimes. And you know, cinnamon is good at regulating blood sugar. Yes.
Yeah, so is also just...
I mean, so is turkey.
I don't do that either. So it's like, there's a number of things I can do, like...
Eat cinnamon!
There are not cinnamon involved. Well, you know, I like Big Red gum. Does that count?
Yuck.
And Big Red soda. Is it Big Red soda cinnamon soda?
Big Red is not cinnamon.
Oh,
but
not
Big
okay.
Red gum does have the cinnamon in it.
Okay,
I don't know. That makes me sick.
There you go.
Big Red gum, it makes me want to throw up.
So you will be drinking your eggnog during the break, and I will be eating my chitlins during the break. So anyway, y'all, so don't be disappointed if you don't see us. I don't get a new episode the last week of the month. They'll probably take a week off probably the end of January as well. But don't worry, you still got several episodes in the meantime. So... Doc, we're out of time. Say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our editor is Laura Ellis. Our engineer is Kojin Toshiro.
For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.